Thanks for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates says we're entering the endgame in Iraq, while the Joint Chiefs of Staff says he's not convinced. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs says he's not convinced we're winning in Afghanistan. President Bush this week announced plans to shift troops out of Iraq and into Afghanistan. The U.S. has stepped up attacks on militants on both sides of the Afghani-Pakistan border, while Pakistan's new president faces anger over an unauthorized U.S. raid into his country. Joining me for the Friday News Roundup, David Ignatius of the Washington Post, Martin Walker of UPI, and Julian Barnes of the Los Angeles Times. Gentlemen, welcome.
Good morning. Good morning.
Nice to have you. Give us a call, 1-800-433-8850, drshow@wamu.org is our email address. David, this raid across the border from Afghanistan into Pakistan. Don't know a lot about it, but give us what you know, and what's the significance of this change in U.S. policy?
This was a commando raid about a week ago, helicopter-borne U.S. forces going across the Pakistan border, fairly deep into Pakistan, to attack Taliban militants. The importance of it is that it's reflective of a more aggressive new effort by the U.S. to pursue the people who are causing us the most problems in Afghanistan, who are coming across this very porous border from safe havens in Pakistan. We now know, thanks to reporting in the New York Times, that there was a new order by President Bush in July authorizing this more aggressive policy. Before, the rules of engagement said you could go 6 miles into Pakistan in hot pursuit of the people you were chasing. Now it's clear you can go a good deal further. The reason this is really going to be a difficult issue for the U.S. is that the Pakistani government has not signed off on it. The chief of staff of the Pakistani army made that clear this week, that they have been informed but have not agreed to this new policy, and they regard it as a gross violation of their sovereignty. I think, Steve, the final thing to say about this is that in part what the U.S. is doing is trying to provoke the Pakistanis into more aggressive counterterrorism operations themselves. They're basically saying, unless you do more about this, we are going to come across your border. We're going to embarrass you. We're going to get your population upset at the violations of your sovereignty. So do it yourselves.
Now, Martin, what's your analysis as to why, after all this time, the Pakistanis have not been more aggressive in pursuing Taliban redoubts in their mountainous regions? It's interesting because, as David says, Pakistan government was rather critical. The Afghani government, the person of President Karzai, was actually supportive of the American change in policy. Give me your take on this.
Well, ever since Pakistan was founded, the Pakistani government in Islamabad has followed the old British tradition, which is that their writ does not run, their law does not operate inside the largely autonomous tribal areas of the northwest frontier. And that's always been the case. This is where the Pashtun
very remote, very mountainous, very hard to get to.
Absolutely.
Run by tribal
hierarchies.
Run by
Pashtun tribal hierarchies and so on. And I've been there. It's a very lawless place. Kotal, you can buy anything in the wide open guns market there and so on. And so for the Pakistanis, it would be very, very difficult to actually impose their authority there. And let's not forget, they've lost something like the lives of 1,800 troops in their various operations in this part of the world. What's interesting is the timing. Why was it in July that President Bush signed this executive order? Well, I think has something to do with the speech that Obama gave, Senator Obama, on July the 15th, when he laid out his own foreign policy statement, including that the need to go across the border, and if the Pakistani authorities would not take care of this, then the Americans really ought to do it for themselves, which I think raised some of the stakes there, and it was certainly what many in the Pentagon had been urging for some
time.
But
wasn't it interesting, Martin, that he was called naive, if I'm quoting correctly,
by
some of his opponents, and now it appears that the administration is following a policy similar to what he suggested.
Entirely so. And indeed, they're following the policy of taking troops from Iraq, putting them into Afghanistan, which is the policy that Senator Obama had been proposing for some time. But there's another factor here, which is that one of the reasons why the Pakistanis were so outraged by all this is that the Americans have not been paying the bills. They had to cut a check for something like $650 million very, very quickly in order to pay the transit fees, which are running at about $1.5 million a day, for all of those trucks going through Pakistan to supply the 33,000 NATO troops that are up there in and operating inside Afghanistan. So there was, and the troops were, the trucks were stopped as they went up the Khyber Pass by the governor of Peshawar until that money arrived.
Julian, let me bring you in here and give me your assessment of why now and why this new policy. After all, there is a downside risk, possibility of Americans being captured or even killed inside Pakistan, which could be very embarrassing and difficult to explain.
Absolutely. There's a, within the Pentagon, there's a real tension between the people who want short-term, who are looking at the short-term and want to increase these strikes in Pakistan, and those who say the only real long-term solution is to build up education systems, improve the frontier corps on the Pakistan side, help the Pakistanis help themselves. What changed here was rising death tolls in Afghanistan. As the U.S. casualties started mounting, commanders in Afghanistan started getting worried, and they convinced top military leaders in the Pentagon to say, we've got to do something more. We know that several months before Bush signed that order, the Pentagon pushed over its own version of a expanded order that would allow more raids into Pakistan. And we're seeing the results of Bush's order in all through August and now. Stepped up Predator attacks, now more ground raids going in by CIA, Special Forces and maybe CIA as well.
Now, to that very point, David, your own paper, the Washington Post, reported this week, I think it was Craig Whitlock from reporting from Pakistan, a very long story saying there's a whole new approach towards searching for Osama bin Laden, who, of course, is the prime target in those lawless areas that Martin was talking about, and that this new strategy would involve not only these forces but these unmanned predators that Julian was talking about. Give me a sense of that, of the particular, not only the general, but the particular search for Osama bin Laden. Is it just, is this George Bush trying one last time before he leaves office to bring him home dead or alive, as he said so often during the campaign?
You know, obviously they'd love to get him on their way out of office. Essentially, I think this new effort is a recognition of how difficult it's proven to be to target him with the very limited human intelligence that we have. You'd think that a 6'6" Saudi gentleman would be somebody you could spot in these tribal areas, but that's proved to be very, very difficult. So in place of that, a specific targeting, they've increasingly been going after senior al-Qaeda lieutenants in these areas in Waziristan along this frontier where the safe havens are being reconstituted using these predator unmanned planes and Hellfire missiles. There have been, I believe, 11 of these Predator attacks this year. That's significantly more than previously. And they're going after more junior al-Qaeda lieutenants, but people we still think are very dangerous. They claim to have gotten two key people in these attacks this year.
One of the things you mentioned, which is also highlighted in that story, was the absence of intelligence on the ground. There was one American officer, CIA officer, quoting that saying, I'm a blue-eyed, you know, blonde guy. I can't mix in these areas. Is part of the underlying problem the failure to recruit people who are capable of infiltrating these areas, who speak the native languages, who can pass for locals? There seems to be a big intelligence gap here.
Well, you know, that's the riddle. The job of the CIA case officer in a place like the remote areas of Pakistan is to recruit local agents who can get to places that the officer cannot. And we've had mixed success with that. Steve Call's book described the efforts we'd made during the 1990s to penetrate these organizations. I have a novel called Body of Lies that's about that same subject. It's not easy.
Which is about to come out as a movie,
yes,
isn't
it? Yes, indeed. Leonardo DiCaprio in the movie. But
everybody's idea of a CIA agent. Yeah, go ahead.
Just wait for the movie. But so it's not easy. I think it's telling that the United States, having difficulty with the fundamentals of intelligence, recruitment of agents who can get inside the tent, as it were, turns to technology, which is our trump card. Turns to these missiles fired from unmanned drones high in the sky.
Martin, pick up on one other thing about Pakistan. New president this week in Pakistan, the widower of Benazir Bhutto, and Asif Ali Zardari. Significance of his election, a man who spent 11 years in jail under corruption charges, although never convicted of them. Talk about him and the significance of his choice.
Mr. 10% was his nickname. Well, he started off very, very strongly and very, very controversially. Even though he didn't have an overall majority with his own party, and he thought he was going to have to be governing in coalition with Nawaz Sharif, another former prime minister. In fact, through a whole series of manoeuvres and alliances, he's managed to get himself a very clear mandate. The last of the regional parliaments gave him a unanimous mandate to be president. He has also decided not to give up, as he had promised he would, those extraordinary powers that General Musharraf abrogated to himself while he was president. So he can still sack judges and so on at will. He still can...
Which was the very issue that helped bring Musharraf down, his high-handed attitude toward judges.
Indeed so. The problem is that the economy, which had been doing really rather well under Musharraf, growing at about 7 or 8% a year, has just absolutely gone into the sink. Indeed, there's an IMF team is arriving there today in Pakistan. The stock market's down by about 45%. Their $15 billion of reserves are down by two-thirds.
Quickly,
it's disastrous in the economy.
Quickly, Martin, do you expect the new prime minister, the new president, to be more or less pro-American than Musharraf?
There's a limit to how pro-American he can be. It's understood, I've heard this from Pakistani diplomats, that he had given the Bush administration to understand that he would turn a bit of a blind eye to some of these cross-border attacks and so on. But he's very, very limited in how far he can accept that, given A, the army doesn't like it, B, large swathes of Pakistani public opinion don't like it, and C, he's in a highly controversial position, having tried to keep these powers unto himself. And Pakistan is looking pretty much like a failed state right now.
And the army chief of staff very much against him, so that's part of what we're going to have to see. Okay, we're going to be right back with your calls and your comments and my panel on foreign policy, so stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. And as always on our Friday News Roundup, the second hour on foreign policy, Martin Walker of UPI is with me. Also, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Julian Barnes of The Los Angeles Times. 1-800-433-8850 is our number. drshow@wamu.org is our email address. Julian, next door to Pakistan, Afghanistan, also some news this week. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on Capitol Hill saying he is not convinced that the United States is winning the war in Afghanistan. A year ago, Afghanistan was the success story compared to Iraq, which was having so many problems. What was behind General Mullen's comments and his give us a sense of his analysis here?
Admiral Mullen has been talking about Afghanistan for a long time here. He's been talking about the need to shift resources to Afghanistan, voiced a lot of concern even before he became the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. This week on Capitol Hill, he announced he was going to create commissioning a new strategy, one that would link both the Pakistan strategy and the Afghanistan strategy, rather than trying to have two separate military and diplomatic approaches, try to see them as one problem, which, of course, they are. Now, he's hampered by how many more troops that he can send over there. They've asked for 3 brigades from Afghanistan. It's not ready yet. So he's more limited in what they can do, but he's wanting to focus people there.
Now, the president did announce there would be a movement to, I think, one Marine brigade
We have a Marine battalion coming in November, but that'll be a net loss because we have a larger Marine force that's leaving then. And then we'll have the force levels will go up in January, February timeframe when another Army brigade arrives.
Give us a sense, for, David, your sense of on-the-ground situation in Afghanistan. What is Mullen talking about? Why is he not convinced we're winning?
I've been to Afghanistan twice this year, so let me base my comments, Steve, on what I saw and reflections afterwards. Mullen essentially was saying this week, we're failing because we have an insurgency that's based across the border that is able to come in and disrupt areas as we try to clear them and stabilize them. They get in effect reinfiltrated. When I was in the eastern part of Afghanistan, where the worst fighting in recent months has been, I saw in January and then in May what looked to me like some progress. Certainly, as you traveled around with U.S. forces, as you went into these remote areas in Jalalabad, that province, in Kunar province, right along the Pakistan border, in Nuray province up in the north, you had a sense that we were finally learning how to use the tools of counterinsurgency. There were very active PRTs building roads, building schools, and that seemed to have some impact. In these very remote mountainous areas, people were beginning to come down out of the mountains. There were, you know, fewer safe havens for the guerrillas to operate. Then you had over the summer waves of attacks as Taliban moved across the border. We couldn't stop them. They came in, disrupted U.S. forces. I emailed some of the colonels that I met and talked with when I was touring, saying, "What happened? You know, it looked like you guys finally had your arms around this." And their answer is, privately, but this is essentially what Mullen said publicly this week to the Congress, until we get a handle on what's on the other side of the border, until we have teams there working with people, building roads, doing the fundamentals to stabilize the situation, we will not get a handle on what's on the other side.
This gets to Julian's point that what they're saying is there has to be a joint strategy for both sides of the border.
It is a war across this border. Unless you see it as one war and in some way combine the Pakistan-Afghanistan pieces, you won't win it.
Now, Martin, bring in another piece of this puzzle, which is the role of NATO. This is not an American mission solely. This is a NATO mission. There's been reluctance on the part of a number of the NATO allies, even though they've sent troops to engage in combat. Give us a sense of that piece here.
Well, both the Germans and the French, who've got troops there, have got very, very tight restrictions upon their use. They can't go out after dark. They're not meant to go out on aggressive patrolling. They're meant to have Sundays off, this kind of thing. It's as though it's a peacetime mission. The Canadians, the Dutch, the Brits are the ones who've been doing the actual fighting alongside the Americans. But the Canadians, now facing an election, are going to be pulling out in 2011, saying quite rightly, after losing almost 100 men, they've done their bit. The French are probably going to step up a bit further. They've just lost 10 paratroops, but President Sarkozy is in favor of doing it. The Germans are not going to increase their exposure. What is and the British are prepared to increase their input as they step down a bit further in Iraq. What is dismaying a lot of the NATO allies on this is that because of various political decisions taken by the Karzai government and to a lesser degree by the US, the battle is not just now against the Taliban. It's also against some of the big Afghan warlords like Haqqani, like Hekmatyar and so on. And that's partly to do with the insistence this is also about a war on drugs. And the difficulty in trying to rally Afghan peasants, for whom drugs are a very important cash crop, to a Kabul government which is in hock to an American government which says we have a war on drugs, let's eradicate the drugs.
I mean, isn't this one of the critical moving parts that the revenue to fuel a lot of this insurgency, either from the Taliban or from these warlords, is coming from the sale of opium, and the attempts by the Americans and Karzai to really limit that trade have not been very successful.
Absolutely. I mean, the entire, something like half of the GDP of Afghanistan is based upon opium. The best idea I ever heard was one that Tony Blair put to George Bush, which was, why don't we just buy up the entire opium crop every year, which would be a great deal cheaper than the war. And apparently Bush replied, don't you know we've got a war on drugs?
Ask you, Julian, because all of these issues are connected, because the suggestion of moving more troops into Afghanistan and the ability to devote more troops to Afghanistan is directly linked to the situation in Iraq. president talked to, this week about drawing down about 8,000 troops. He called it a payment on success. He obviously wants to leave office with a sense that the surge continues to be successful and that the drawdown of troops being the most visible evidence of that. Talk about the what the president's analysis is, what the analysis is within the administration, and the counter comments by some critics who said, well, really all this is cosmetic, and that the really tough questions about the future of the military mission are being left for the next president.
I think that that's right. I mean, we had there was a debate inside the government, inside the administration, about how fast to draw down in Iraq. You saw the Joint Chiefs wanting a sharper drawdown. General Petraeus wanting to keep 15.
Petraeus being the on-the-ground commander.
Right, the on-the-ground commander in Iraq, who's going to become the CENTCOM regional commander, advocating for keeping 15 brigades in Iraq for a much longer time period past the end of the Bush administration. When Bush gave his speech this week, he talked about the surge and the improvement in security there in terms that reflected a little more confidence that it will be permanent. You still see warnings from commanders in Iraq that that things could go badly. A lot of the other countries contributing troops, although they were small, are leaving, and that has been actually had an effect. Georgia took out a brigade, obviously, and that has caused the U.S. forces to have to fill some of those roles. So what we have is a debate within the military on how to prioritize Afghanistan versus Iraq. You have the Bush administration saying, we do want to improve Afghanistan, but you know, we got to leave Iraq. Okay.
Now, David, this whole issue, of course, is front and center in the political campaign, and one of the ways in which it is intruded is Barack Obama, in a recent interview, found himself with Bill O'Reilly, found himself saying that the surge had succeeded beyond wildest dreams, but he tried to make a distinction, saying it might have succeeded militarily in pacifying a number of regions, but that the political payoff, the reconciliation of the political factions, has not ensued, even though that was the hope. Give us an update on that.
Well, I think Obama's right. There's little evidence that the kind of reconciliation that the surge was intended to create has really happened. Maliki is somewhat more popular. Maliki, the Shiite prime minister, is somewhat more popular with Sunnis than he was, but people are still very suspicious of him. I think that there is a debate that still needs to take place, recognizing that what we call the surge has been successful in reducing violence, about precisely what it was in the surge that was decisive. And this is important not just in terms of understanding what happened in Iraq, but in terms of thinking about what to do in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Was it the additional numbers of troops, was it the raw size of the force that made the difference, or was it the different tactics that were adopted and the different ways of working with the population? I think there are growing numbers of people in the U.S. military who think it was the latter. And that's important because if you can avoid sending thousands and thousands more troops to Afghanistan, creating, as you do that, antibodies within the population. I mean, people don't like to be occupied, whether they're in Afghanistan or Pakistan.
Well, it's been called the Anbar Awakening. A lot of people are saying the real key difference was the change in attitude among the sheikhs.
Let me underline, yes, the sheikhs decided to come over, but we learned how to work with them. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Anbar province in 2003, 2004. The sheikhs were ready to help much earlier than they did. We blew them off. And part of what happened was we learned how to play tribal politics. I'm looking at my friend Martin and thinking, you know, we learned some of the skills of the British as imperial. We learned to work with these people. We learned to give them money. We learned a kind of operating style. So if those are the lessons we can apply in Afghanistan, it can be done with far fewer troops and arguably less of a mess.
Martin, you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I think it's worth adding that there are other factors in the pacifying or the increased pacification, including the ceasefire that was declared by Muqtada al-Sadr, including also the relative restraint that I think has been shown by the Iranians in fomenting disorder inside Iraq. They've certainly backed off. The bad news is, David's absolutely right, and Obama was right, is that we haven't had the political payoff. We haven't yet had an agreement on a hydrocarbons law or on how to share out the spoils of oil in Iraq. The last one, the Kurds vetoed.
But this week, week, let me just quickly, Martin, this week there was a development on the oil front.
Not a good one. Not a particularly good one.
But bring that into your analysis.
Well, there have been six short-term, one-year oil development contracts with a number of Western organizations. They've all been stopped by the Iraqis. They hadn't got very far. They weren't achieving very much. And what the Iraqis now say they want to do is, pending getting a full-scale oil law that is agreed by the Iraqi parliament, they want to have full-scale development contracts. And the first one has actually been negotiated with the Chinese, of all people. But the really important point is, in the last 10 days, the Maliki government has issued arrest orders for a number of those Sunni tribal chieftains who have been key to the Holy Awakening process. So we still have a great difficulty in putting together a coherent and stable political system inside Iraq.
You've mentioned very briefly the fact that the major oil contract has been signed with China.
Yeah.
And everybody acknowledges that one of the most important geopolitical facts that the next administration is going to have to deal with is the mounting and apparently inexhaustible appetite of a growing China for fuel. That sounds like a very significant detail.
Well, it is. I mean, it looks like the U.S. went to war to ensure China's energy supply, the way things are going at the moment. The Chinese have said that the deal is not actually complete, although some Iraqi sources said that it is. But it's going to be very interesting to see which of the oil corporations get the final contracts and what those terms of those contracts will be. The Chinese are offering basically pretty full control to the Iraqis, as I understand it. But we're talking about a country that's already pumping 3 million barrels a day.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. A couple important foreign policy questions, Julian, were raised in the interview with Sarah Palin this week. And one of the most important was the role of NATO. We've mentioned NATO in terms of Afghani obligations. But closer to home, there is the whole question of whether new states, and particularly former states in Soviet Union, should be accepted into NATO, Ukraine and, of course, Georgia. In answering a question, she was asked if she said, I think Georgia should be a member of NATO, and then said, and if that happens, probably, I think the word she specifically used was perhaps, but she seemed to be favoring the notion that the United States would then be on the line to militarily defend Georgia. This is a pretty significant issue going down the line. Give us your analysis.
It is a significant issue, but it's also just sort of a factual statement by Sarah Palin. I mean, if Georgia was a member of NATO, we would have a treaty obligation to defend them if they were invaded. And that's why this is such a controversial issue among NATO members. The United States maintains it does want to find a path to membership for Georgia and Ukraine, but NATO operates on consensus, and there's disagreement within the alliance right now on how to proceed on that point, and you're going to see in the final days of the Bush administration a lot of diplomacy on that front to try to get a consensus.
And David, the Russian incursion into those breakaway provinces and to some extent into Georgia itself, although they're in the process of pulling some of those troops back, did that give people second thoughts about the notion of including Georgia and Ukraine in NATO, given the doctrine that Sarah Palin repeated, that it's NATO rules that you defend a member state from invasion?
It certainly gave European second thoughts. I think it made them very nervous about the process. And I think it has created a really interesting but so far suppressed issue in this presidential campaign. John McCain has been one of the most fervent advocates of Georgian rights. He's very friendly personally with the president of Georgia, Mikhail Saakashvili, who we refer to often as mercurial, because he is one of the most volatile personalities. This is a man who, by every account I've read, decided to strike first in this breakaway province of South Ossetia on August 8th, trying to block what he thought was a Russian invasion.
Sarah Palin said it was an unprovoked attack, which is not what a lot of people think.
She should talk to people in the White House who will disagree with her. But Obama, after initially having a fairly cautious and I would say, quite sensible approach to this. Let's look. Let's think about diplomacy. Has been pushed by some of his advisors to match McCain and now Palin in pro-Georgia rhetoric. I mean, McCain said, we're all Georgians, and there's this desire to stand with the underdog. In truth, Obama and the Obama campaign could make a very strong argument that that's McCain's statements and the way he has egged on Saakashvili and what have been arguably somewhat reckless actions is a real vulnerability, that it illustrates a problem with McCain's approach to foreign policy. They haven't really made that argument yet.
Quickly, Martin, your take on
that. Well, McCain is still in a Cold War mindset. I mean, he's talked about getting Russia expelled from the G8 group and so on. I think there were provocations on both sides, certainly building up to this to this action. But I don't think it's I think it's worth bearing in mind that even if there were to be an agreement that Georgia and Ukraine were to come into NATO among the NATO countries, that's a treaty. It would have to be ratified by two-thirds of the member of the U.S. Senate. Yeah. It's not down to the White House alone to decide that.
And a Senate that almost certainly will be strongly in control of the Democrats.
Will the Europeans, who decided on Monday at a meeting with the Ukraine not even to give the Ukraine the prospect of joining the European Union.
Hold your thought, Martin. We'll be right back with your calls and comments. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Miriam Muscarolis and Grant Abramson, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming, by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org, and by AMARC Foundation, supporting procon.org, with the 2008 presidential candidates' positions on many issues at procon.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Maurice Sendak celebrates his 80th birthday Monday with a benefit at the 92nd Street Y in Manhattan. On the next Fresh Air, we celebrate by listening back to an interview with him. Sendak is the author of the classic children's books Where the Wild Things Are and In the Night Kitchen. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane today. And as always on our Friday News Roundup, the second hour, we're talking on foreign policy. And our guests here today, Martin Walker of UPI, Julian Barnes of the Los Angeles Times, David Ignatius of the Washington Post. Let me read some emails and try to get some quick answers here. This is from Robin in Milford, Delaware. Since things are so much better in Iraq and worse in Afghanistan, is it possible the insurgents have moved from Iraq to Afghanistan? Julian?
I don't think that we've seen a wholesale movement of al-Qaeda in Iraq to set up base in Afghanistan. I mean, the flow of foreign fighters, if you're a foreign fighter in Yemen, you may now be setting your sights on the border of Pakistan, Afghanistan, as opposed to going into Iraq. David, correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think we know of any huge change in the flow of foreign fighters.
No, I think it's fair to say that al-Qaeda, to the extent there's still a sort of central command, sees that it suffered real setbacks in Iraq. Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia really is on its back heels. And increasingly, they see the central front as being in these tribal areas in Pakistan. That's where their safe havens are. That's where they're coming at us and everybody else from.
Let me read this from Marilyn in Arvada or Arvada, Colorado. Could you discuss Sarah Palin's ignorance of the Bush doctrine and her eagerness to go to war with Russia over Georgia? How do people around the world see her? We talked about her comments about Georgia and Russia, but this other foreign policy dimension of her interview with Charlie Gibson, in which he asked her what you think of the Bush doctrine, Martin?
Well, it was pretty clear she didn't know exactly what the Bush doctrine was, but she can be forgiven for that because I think an awful lot of people don't, and indeed there were two aspects to it. And it came out in a national security paper that was published in October 2002, and the two aspects which became known as the Bush doctrine were, first of all, the right to take preemptive military action against a state or against an entity that seemed to be close to threatening the United States, and the other aspect of it was that the US would not permit the emergence of a strategic peer competitor, which is to say they wouldn't want to see the emergence of another Soviet Union, which was an equal, which I think is something that is stuck very firmly in the consciousness of people in Beijing, who see themselves as very much becoming getting that kind of status. So I don't blame Sarah Palin for not being up on the detail of that. I mean, people like us who are talking here, this is our living. We cover this stuff all the time.
And as you say, there is a significant disagreement of exactly what it means. Let me read you this one, David. This concerns the Washington Post, your paper, the new book by Bob Woodward, editor of associate editor, I think is his title, but excerpts published this week in the Post. The new book by Bob Woodward on Bush's handling of the Iraq War confirms the worst suspicions of many of us had about his mishandling and misrepresentation of the war, adding further even more alarming, disturbing facts. This is a independent balance analysis about Bush's performance that we didn't know about. What are your panel's thoughts about what this book reveals? What's your take, reading the excerpts, or if you've read the whole book, what's your take on Woodward's book?
My strongest sense is that it reveals even more than the previous installments in the series Bob has been writing, the degree of disorder within the administration, the extent to which you had military officers disagreeing with civilians, in which you had outside experts like retired General Jack Keane freelancing, demanding an opportunity to go over and consult privately with General Petraeus in Baghdad. You have a sense of a government that was so uncertain about the right way forward, certainly in the fall of 2006, as the president was realizing this ain't working, a very disorderly process. Finally, a decision was reached. That decision produced what we call the surge. I think that Woodward's conclusion is that it was, and we were talking about this before, it wasn't the numbers of troops so much as the tactics, the new techniques that were used to go after insurgents, the new super classified intelligence, fusion cells that put together information that allowed the killing of these terrorists. But my takeaway is, on this biggest issue of the Bush presidency, there's been a degree of disorder that we just, even with all of our reporting, didn't understand before.
Let me turn to some of our callers and give them a chance to join in. And let's start with Natalie in Wichita Falls, Texas. Welcome. You're on the air, Natalie.
Hello. A wonderful show again, Mr. Roberts, the Diane Rehm Show. Hello, panel. I want to get some quick comments off to you if I can. First, I want to piggyback on something one of the panelists said a few minutes ago regarding John McCain's remark that we are all Georgians. Well, for some of us who have long memories, it's interesting to think that Stalin was a Georgian. That's a very, very interesting point there. That said, I have some ideas about why we're so interested in Georgia lately. We do have a very strained relationship with Putin. I call it strained at death. But there's a nation very close to Georgia that we would like to keep an eye on, and that is Iran, also a very oil-rich nation. I think this is really what it's all about. Now, as for the what I call a preposterous idea of invading, let alone attacking Russia, well, if we know our history in a general way, Napoleon tried that, I think St. Petersburg, if I have that right. The names from Moscow have changed. And he left legions of men to die of starvation and cold.
Okay, I think we've got your point, and I appreciate it very much, Natalie. Julian, deal with this issue of that Natalie raised. The focus on Georgia. We've talked about the potential as a NATO country, but she also raises another very critical question, which is its position in terms of availability of oil from that and the pipelines that run through it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the pipelines are important, but I think that the United States' focus on Georgia is very much what officials have said. It's an emerging democracy. The Bush administration has emphasize that, and that's why that there was sort of excitement about extending the NATO, extending EU to formerly undemocratic nations. And I think that, I mean, you can't dismiss the pipelines that go through Georgia, but I think that the U.S. interest in Georgia is primarily one of, that it is becoming less autocratic and more democratic.
And Martin, a number of callers have called in and said, why are people so willing to forgive Sarah Palin's not knowing the Bush Doctrine? And they said, most people are not running for vice president of the United States. It just shows her shallow preparation for this job. Your reaction?
Well, I think it's a bit unfair because I think an awful lot of people don't know exactly what the Bush Doctrine would be. Perhaps not even President Bush himself. After all, he didn't coin the phrase. It was journalists who put the title Bush Doctrine onto it. Just adding one point onto what Julian said, that the pipeline really is important. The Russians have got an absolute monopoly upon all of the oil routes, pipelines coming out of Russian, Siberian, Central Asian, Kazakh, Turkmen, gas and oil, with the one exception of this pipeline that goes from Baku in Azerbaijan through Georgia and out into Turkey. It is the one breach in the Russian control of the whole of Eurasia's oil supply. And as a result, it is very, very important.
Good point. Let's turn to Cynthia in Vernon, New York, or Mount Vernon, New York. Welcome. You're on the show.
Hello, everyone. It's Vernon, New York.
Happy to have you, Cynthia.
Okay, thanks for taking my call. I have a concern and comment about the responsibility of the media. It's acknowledged, to my understanding, that the folks in the media were cheerleaders during the lead-up and the attack on Iraq. And there were many, many people in the international community against the war. And I know from experience that we didn't get much coverage. Now, I just want to repeat to you as a cautionary comment, the same thing is happening now because it's disgraceful, in my view, that the protests against the war at the conventions are not really covered. Just as a comparison, there were 100 times much coverage about those protests over the torch for the Olympics. And I really think that people... many people are opposed to the war, but that point of view is not really being covered adequately.
Thank you, Cynthia. David?
Well, I think the media has learned a lot from our difficulty, you could argue our inability, to ask enough tough questions in the run-up to the Iraq War. Many news organizations were preparing to cover it more than they were questioning the reasons for it, because they felt the decision had been made, and there were some anti-war protests, but there wasn't as much to cover then in 2002 and 2003 as would have made it easier. So I think we have learned something. The discussion we've been having today about Afghanistan: should we have more troops in Afghanistan? What would they do? What's the real lesson of the surge? I think, you know, and that goes on all over the media, is reflective of a more questioning, appropriately skeptical look. These are big issues of war and peace. The cost to the country of what happened in Iraq is immense. So I think people should understand that in our business, we have looked at this and tried to think about it and tried to do a better job.
And I think most media people would acknowledge that a lot of mistakes were made in reporting, and that poorly sourced stories, but it was very hard to find a lot of information. But looking back, a lot of the stories, even the most reputable news organizations wrote, turned out to have a lot of holes in them.
I think when we go back and look at the story in our business, there's room for an awful lot of self-criticism.
And so there's room for an awful lot of self-criticism by the US government, which put out people like Colin Powell to tell what turned out to be untruths about the reasons for the war.
And I think you see the difference in coverage of Pakistan now, too, with people very much questioning what the government is saying, trying to really get a lot of this stuff is secret, and we're trying to find out what's happening.
Let me turn to Bill in College Park. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show, Bill.
Hello. My comment was there seems to be a huge disconnect between both the parties and the media. McCain talks about we've had troops in Germany and Japan since World War II, and everybody's like, why? You know, those wars are over. We should bring them home. And nobody I talk to thinks we have any business in the Republic of Georgia or the Republic of Ukraine. We have a right to be in Afghanistan, and we should be concentrating on that. We were attacked, but we need to stop being the police force of the world. And I'll take your comments off the air.
Thank you. Martin?
Well, it's if the U.S. is not going to act the role of the world's policeman or the world's security guarantor of last resort, who on earth is? And just how unstable would the world become? And a world in which the U.S. is now so absolutely economically interdependent that over 30 cents out of every dollar of wealth this country creates comes out of foreign trade, foreign investment, interdependence with that global economy.
And as you pointed out, one of the rising factors is the access to supplies of oil and the pipelines you were talking about, and then see how so many of these stories link together, because the Chinese entry into Iraq as a consumer of their oil only highlights the growing importance of access to oil as a geopolitical factor.
And it's not just access to oil. The United States has been playing for a long time the role that the British Empire used to play of guaranteeing things like the freedom of the seas, guaranteeing things like the basic stability of the global financial system. There wouldn't have been Chinese economic growth, Indian economic growth, without the U.S. playing that role.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's see if we can get at least one more call. And Bart in Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show, Bart.
Oh, thank you, Steve. I guess my point was briefly discussed while I was on hold, but and once again, I feel like the opium issue and the drug trade was just underestimated the power of it. And you folks quoted the percentage of the economy. Is that the reason we're not? I mean, we've all got Google Earth on our home computers. I imagine the U.S. government knows the address and the square footage of everything is over there. Is the concern just destroying their economy, or what are we afraid of here when we know it's financing bullets that are heading our direction? What am I missing?
Good question. What are we afraid of, Dave?
Well, it's not that we're afraid of it. We're just not sure what the right strategy is. If you fly over Afghanistan, if you fly over Kandahar province in May, you see poppy everywhere you look. I mean, you know, you're almost afraid to breathe in deeply. You see people out harvesting the poppy, and they're not afraid of anybody. And the reason is nobody's going after them in many parts of the country. Why is that? It's because there's a difference of opinion among the NATO allies about whether it makes sense to eradicate poppy now, go after it, or whether there are other development strategies that should be brought to bear.
Can there be a replacement crops, you know, that will provide economic benefit to the local people?
Replacement crops. These are very primitive areas, and people have turned to poppy because it's a way to make money. The crop is now much bigger than it was before. But I just would note, I mean, I've heard British development experts in Kandahar tell me the last thing you want to do is stop them from growing poppy. It'll help the insurgents if you do.
Two very quick questions here about two issues that are also on our radar screen. Kim Jong-il, Martin, leader of North Korea, hasn't been seen for several weeks. Reports he might have had a stroke. What do we know?
Well, we don't know for sure anything, except we know there's a Chinese medical team has gone in. We hear from South Korean intelligence that he's had some kind of stroke. He's been operated upon. He's still somewhat in charge. It doesn't look as though it's time to go to get to panic stations about the succession. But we also know that there seems to be a whole new missile launch site being developed in North Korea, and the talks on their nuclear ambitions seem to be getting nowhere.
And Julian, in Latin America, you had the American ambassadors booted out of both Venezuela and Bolivia by presidents in that country. Significance of this?
Well, we also had Russian bombers visit Venezuela, and we have...
As part of a military exercise.
A military exercise and talk of Russia with increased ties to Cuba. So, you know, you have a situation where deteriorating relationships with Venezuela and the prospect of a greater Russian role there, that's probably more to tweak us over Georgia, but still something that the administration is looking very closely at.
And the way these stories tie together, the United States imports, if I'm not mistaken, $40 billion worth of oil from Venezuela.
Huge amount now, and that is a point of leverage that Chavez has over the United States. Right now, that's still flowing, but that could change.
That's Julian Barnes from the Los Angeles Times. Martin Walker from United Press International has been with me, as well as David Ignatius of The Washington Post. Look for the movie Body of Lies coming out in October that's made from David's novel. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in for Diane today, and I very much appreciate you all listening, so thanks a lot.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from Softscribe, and podcasts.